All right. Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to the Company Forensics podcast today. In this episode, we are talking about fundraising outside of Silicon Valley and New York and Austin, and in general, fundraising outside these major startup hubs, which is a question we're getting more often as we see more startups coming from outside of the U.S., outside of these hubs, right? So how do you raise money there? How do you raise money if you don't have access to the usual Silicon Valley investors? So joining us today is Cedric Waldberger. I met Cedric a long time ago in Seed Starts. That's back in 2016. And we met face-to-face long before this pandemic times. Cedric invests in early-stage technology companies through his venture capital firm Tomahawk VC. He's an entrepreneur himself, and he was involved in the early stages of the Definity Foundation, the Silicon Valley unicorn. He also invested in Frontify, which recently raised a decent amount of funding. And then finally, Cedric is part of our Slidman Expert Network. So you will be able to book Cedric for office hours if you're interested. But as we get started, we are going to talk about fundraising outside the US. Cedric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited. Good to reconnect.
Yes, it's good to reconnect. So Cedric, I guess that the first question, so you're based out of Switzerland, you're Swiss. And then the first question, I probably have my own opinion or my own answer to this, but how do you see fundraising happening differently in Switzerland and in Europe in general versus what you see in the US?
Yeah, so I've personally raised funds in Europe and the US, and then I'm also, the last few years, I've sat on the investor side. So I've invested in a lot of companies, both in the US and in Switzerland, or Europe, I should say. I'm based in Switzerland, but I spend most of my time in all the European ecosystems, all the bigger ones. What are some of the main differences that I see? I think in general, the US is always about 10 years ahead. So what I see is when I first raised funds, this was in a startup in 2011, and we tried to raise in Europe, couldn't find anyone that was bold enough to bet on that venture. We actually ended up raising from a Chinese investor at the time. And I think that's still kind of the dynamic that I see. The US or Asia to some degree are always a bit more, they take bigger risks than what we do in Europe. With Tomahawk, we're trying to change that. I have a knack for really crazy ideas, but overall, I think there's a few reasons why investors in the US and in Asia are willing to bet more on these binary type of companies that either become really big and have a huge impact or go to zero. And Europeans, at least historically, had a preference for businesses that were more linear, meaning they wanted to see first revenues, first user growth, and then just bet or invest in the growth of that. And I think one reason is that Europe is so fragmented. So it's a lot harder to build a unicorn just based on market size in Europe for a lot of business models than it is in the US or Asia, where you just generally have access to a lot, much, much bigger target markets.
Got it. And so in the US, we have a bit of a symptom of investors always wanting to raise money within their, I mean, within their, definitely within their country, ideally within their city, right? A founder they can sit down with, a founder they can see, you know, they can monitor, that they know is around. How do you see that differently in Europe? Are investors across Europe willing to invest in companies in other countries?
I'd say definitely more so than what I've seen in the US, just by the fact that Europe is so fragmented. I think There's a few hubs, Berlin, London, maybe Paris, and maybe two or three more, but that's about it. And so if you're not in one of those hubs, until I'd say 3 or 4 years ago, you didn't really have enough deal flow to justify focusing on just one city. I personally first started working remotely in 2009, so 12 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that experience and seeing how it gave me access to a much, much bigger talent pool, that very early on convinced me that that's the way big companies and successful, impactful companies of the future are going to be built. They're going to leverage that access to bigger talent pools. And so when I started investing in 2014, I never had a geographical focus. I always believed that I want to find the companies and support them where they are, whether they were remote or just in another city. And then it's even led to me giving up on having a home for a few years. When I started investing between 2014 and 2018, I didn't really have any fixed place. I wasn't based anywhere. I always tried to be where I could find the next exciting idea or spend time with my existing portfolio and bring value to them.
You've been on both sides of the aisle, so I'll ask the question for both ways. First, on the entrepreneur side, how do you find investors in Europe? Assuming that maybe you're not in one of the major hubs, you need to go to investors who are in other cities or in other countries. How does that process work?
I'd say nowadays it's definitely easier since COVID happened. Everyone got used to working remotely. And so I think the fact that you're not in one of those bigger cities doesn't matter as much anymore. But then I think the lesson that I've learned is always about a relationship. It's always about connecting early on, sharing ideas, connecting on a different level than just, hey, I need some money and here's my pitch deck. There's a saying, ask for money and you get advice, ask for advice and you get money. And I think that definitely holds true in the venture space. And so I've rarely ever invested in someone that just approached me with a cold pitch. Most of the times when I have invested, it was when someone was recommended to me through either a mutual friend, a mutual co-investor or a co-investor of mine, or, and that's the best case scenario, through a founder that I've already invested in. So I'd say if I was an entrepreneur now today and I wanted to go out and raise my next round, I would probably ask my friends who are also founders and entrepreneurs for intros, either an investor that they currently have on their board or on their cap table, or someone they've worked with previously. I think that's going to significantly increase your chances of building that relationship, which is so crucial to then partnering up.
Got it. And now tell me about the other way around. So you're an investor now. Where are these deals coming from? Are they mostly intros as well?
So for us, we look at a lot of different sources. Definitely intros, founder intros, and co-investor intros. Those two are our North Star metrics. Where we combine the numbers, it becomes our one North Star metric. That's what we track on a weekly basis. And we incentivize our co-investors and our founders to show us deals that they think we could be good partners for. Beyond that, we also do proactive outreach. So we scan LinkedIn and Product Hunt and a few more platforms automatically and scan it for founders and influencers that we think have had a good experience in the past, have invested in the right startups in the past, or have built interesting companies. And so we try to automatically detect when they're starting to do something new. We also look at a lot of our portfolio companies and see if someone leaves and now updates their title to founder or working something on a stealth startup. So that'd be the second channel, proactive outreach. And then the third one is cold inbound. And being an entrepreneur myself and having been in that situation where I didn't necessarily have the network and I didn't have the time to first go around and ask all my friends to intro me to their investors, we wanted to make it possible for entrepreneurs to also get in touch with us directly. But we also realized that if we just put up a form or an email on our website, that it's going to create a lot of overhead on our end. It's going to create lots of hours where we just go through emails that where the other party, the entrepreneur, hasn't really taken the time to think about whether this is actually a company that we can invest in. Because our focus right now is fintech and DeFi. And so if someone sends me an AgrarTech startup, that's just not for me. And so what we did is we thought we create some barrier that still makes it possible for anyone to get in touch with us, but also makes it impossible for them to just send us an email that they've sent to 100 other investors. And what we did is there's like an automated video interview on our website. So there's a little button in the bottom right. And if you click on that, I then ask you three questions in an automated fashion and kind of like how we're recording this. Your answer is recorded, and that gives us a very good first glimpse at the entrepreneur, and we can kind of see the sparkle in their eye and gather how excited they are about the solution or the problem that they're solving. So those would be the three main deal sources, and if anyone's just starting out, I think that's a great way for them, without having built a network, to still get in touch with us.
Tell me about these companies and sort of like the stage where you're seeing these companies in Europe. In the U.S., I think there's been an evolution in the way funding happens. Why? Because, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, starting a company sort of required a lot of capital, required time, and required servers. You had to purchase servers. But now, like, the barrier has gotten a lot higher simply because starting a company has gotten easier. And it is my perception in the U.S. that investors now expect a lot of traction, expect definitely a team. I think that was always expected, but they expect to build product, they expect a product in the market, because most founders have the ability to do that, right? They can carve out, or they should be able to carve out a couple of months of time to build some prototype and have that live. So now the question is that the expectation in Europe as well?
So we do invest very early stage, pre-seed and seed. So that's typically the first two rounds when it's not friends and family money. But what you said, I would definitely agree with. What we want to see when we meet the founder is we want to see a very strong team, ideally one that's very complementary. So we want to see at least two founders that have different personalities, different skill sets, and aren't afraid to really own their own area. Because we've just seen that as the company grows, that makes it so much easier for both of them to find their role and grow themselves and grow their own team, rather than two founders that are too similar. So that definitely be number one. Number two is excitement for the space and deep knowledge. So especially as it comes to DeFi, decentralized finance, that's where we see a lot of ideas emerge right now. But we want to see passion. We want to see someone that's here for the long term and solves the problem because they think this problem really needs to be solved, not a mercenary that just wants to make money quickly or get rich quickly. And then third, definitely some sort of traction or prototype. Now, when for SaaS, I think we have the clearest metrics. When we meet you and you're starting to raise your pre-seed, we definitely want to see some LOIs, some letter of interest from companies, from enterprises that show that you've talked to those potential customers and that what you've pitched them, they liked and they generally agree that this problem needs solving. When it comes to seed round, we definitely want to see some pilots completed. So you should have a few $100,000 in revenue that you've created in the past. And then when it's your Series A, you definitely want to have a few $100,000 of recurring revenue. So you want to have not just pilot revenue, but recurring revenue.
Okay, yeah. So I guess that looks quite similar to what we detect on this side of the world. So is... To me, maybe that is the most common mistake. Like, I think that founders often underestimate the hard and tiring process that it is to raise money and how much time they need to carve out from the business, inevitably slowing the business down if the CEO is out fundraising. So from my side of the world, that seems like the biggest mistake, trying to raise money at an earliest stage, not only because you're wasting the time, you're not gonna get the money, you're wasting money by wasting time when you could have been working on the business. So again, that to me is one of the biggest mistakes I see, but maybe on your side of the aisle and as an investor, what is the most common problem that you see as founders approach you?
So when a founder approaches me, I have this mental model of CEE. So I try to assess their clarity, their empathy, and their execution skills. Clarity, I think, is super important for a founder because the more clear they are, the less words they need to express their thoughts. That's going to help them scale everything. Fundraising is super important, but also their sales, their hiring. That's going to hugely profit if they're able to break down all their thoughts into just as few words as possible. So that's always a quality that I look for. Empathy, I want to see people that are natural leaders because there is going to be this roller coaster. And if they're just incentivizing their team with money and status and whatnot, then that's not going to work out as soon as there's a downturn. And then last but not least, and I think that's important to, or related to what you said, execution skills. When a founder approaches me, we know that the conversation is going to be at least 4 weeks until we write a check. Well, there's exceptions, but in general, it's like 4 to 8 weeks, typically what we see. And I often on the first meeting ask, what are you going to work on the next 4 weeks? And an answer that I don't like is if someone says, oh, I'm just going to be fundraising. What I do like is when the first that they think of when I ask that is, oh, I'm going to build this feature in the product and we're going to solve this and I'm going to close that customer and so on and so forth. So to answer your question, you could flip those around. Someone that doesn't execute, that focuses just on fundraising, especially in the early stages, I want to see someone that is so excited about their business that fundraising is almost not an afterthought, but they do care so much about the business that they keep working and progressing. Second, empathy. So someone that wouldn't be empathetic, I think I just naturally wouldn't connect with. And clarity. Someone that's not able to give clear, concise answers, usually that's a no after the first meeting.
So I want to talk a little bit about Frontify because it is a business that we're familiar with. And you were one of the earlier investors in Frontify. They recently raised some decent capital. But they started in Switzerland, right?
They started in Switzerland and not even in Zurich. So Zurich is Switzerland's biggest city and they are in a city called St. Gallen, which is about 1.5 hours from Zurich. And I think it's fair to say that they probably employ like 30 to 40% of all front-end engineers in that city by now. They have recently opened an office in New York and they have an office in Germany, but St. Gallen remains their main office, their biggest office.
Yeah, so a lot of questions around that story, and I think it's sort of like leading by example. So, you know, this is a company again, once again, outside the major hubs, even outside of the major city in Switzerland. Tell us about this, the early stage of the team. Tell us what you saw in them. Hopefully other founders can listen in and kind of mimic those skills.
Yeah, so Roger, the founder, he's a solo founder. He started working on the product, the Frontify product, I want to say in 2012. But he started working on that as he had a job in an agency business. He was building websites. He did front-end engineering and some back-end for some of their clients. And he realized how hard it was for any given company to really scale their brand in a consistent way. So for a brand to make sure that their logo and their colors, their fonts, and everything that you would consider visual identity looks the exact same, whether it's on a business card or on your plane. Lufthansa was one of their earliest customers, as well as on their website. And so he started to think about that because he had a passion to solve that problem. And so he started working on it. I think he reduced his work time to 80% and started to work on it one day a week. Then he increased that. At some point, he was full time. But then he still didn't feel like he had true product market fit. So he even went back and took another job, like 40%, so he could keep working on the idea and refine it before he had to raise money. Mm-hmm. And after he closed his first, I think, two or three enterprise customers for pilots, he did get some investors on board for a very small round. That was kind of a friends and family round. Kept building the product, a very small team. It was just him and I think one or two additional engineers at the time. And then he was very clever. Instead of going out and raising more money from investors and diluting himself, he had some of his customers that got really excited about the product pay for some of the additional features that they requested. So once, I think it was Lufthansa at the time, once they requested an additional feature, he gave them an offer, basically how much it would cost for him to build that feature into the product. They would then pay that and by that finance the next, I don't know, 3 to 6 months of his runway. And I thought that was a very clever way of making sure that he was only working on the things that were extremely important to his clients and that they were actually willing to pay for. And from then, he built the team. All in St. Gallen, so it was pretty... It was a very slow start. They made sure they had a great foundation. He brought on a late co-founder as CEO so he could focus on product and tech. And since then, I think they did just two more rounds, one with a VC from England and then the latest round with EQT Ventures from Sweden. And yeah, seemed to be on a great track. Took them a long time to get to 1 million in ARR, but mm-hmm. now they're on this track of tripling twice, doubling three times.
So a little bit on that, like that's, you know, company that reached probably close to that $1 million by having that operation in Europe. This is a business that sells enterprise, that sells to small, medium businesses. But in the end, it like the conclusion, and this is where I'm asking you as an investor, the conclusion that they came to was, you know, we need to have a foot in the U.S. We need to have a presence in the U.S. I think it's a fantastic story on how they held the expensive endeavor of opening an office in New York up until they had the right time. But I'd love to hear other stories or other examples, or you know, do you think that is the right approach on the companies that you've worked with or that you've funded?
I'm usually a big proponent of companies growing beyond their natural home market pretty quickly, because I think, especially in Europe, there's no point in perfecting your home market if your home market is 8 million or even if it's 80 million in Germany or 8 million for Switzerland. I think companies should be bold and go to the US or other big markets early on to make learnings and mistakes in those markets as well so they can scale up sooner. Typically, I think around the time of your Series A is the right time to open an office in a separate country, just because for me that often has to overlap with you generating significant recurring revenue. It means you should have a decent amount of staff or team members by now, 30 plus or probably 50 plus members. And so you will have the foundation in place. You will have the structure, the documentation that you need in order to have two separate offices that are also not just separated by miles and kilometers, but also separated by time zones to have them in sync and running efficiently. But I think it is a crucial point. And for Frontify, it was quite late in their process or in their story when they decided to go to the US. And I think it always needs founder commitment. I think you need to go and someone from the core team needs to go and spend some time in the new office in order for the culture to really transfer to the new office. I think that's such an important point, not just the information, but also the culture. Of course, now we live in a different time when everyone works from home. It's to some degree easier, but it comes with different challenges. But if we're ever going to go back to companies that just have multiple offices in different places, then I think it's important that you create enough opportunities for FaceTime with people. People should be able to travel both ways and spend a bit of time in the other office, because I think that's a crucial part of building the culture.
I mean, we operate similarly, right? We have our office in New York City, our office in Costa Rica. And yes, I think that I've seen the external office model fail many times when that external office feels like a foreign company, right? There are no founders in there. There's nobody high up in the company there. So it feels like a completely external team, separate company culture and so on. You know, I'm still a big believer in the power of in-office collaboration. For example, as we right now are sort of starting to come back to the office after being isolated for almost a year on COVID, a little office dynamic happened, right? And, you know, people that come to you to talk over lunch or over coffee just because you're in the office, but that's not a meeting or a conversation that would have happened over Slack or over Tandem or Zoom or whatever other.
One tool that you mentioned that comes closest to it is Tandem. Tandem is this app that allows you to keep an audio stream open in the background, and so you can have virtual rooms where you talk to one another without seeing each other. And we often keep that on for our mornings for the whole team. We have different rooms, some have music, some don't. And that's led to some pretty fun, spontaneous conversations for me. So I think that at least gets close to that. But I agree with you that in general, it's very hard to replicate that in a virtual environment.
Yeah, I agree. We tried Tandem actually as we went into pandemic. To me, Tandem was the first option. And I agree, it's the one that probably comes closest to replicating that office experience, like the water tank room and so on. It didn't succeed that much with the team. Like in the end, I had to believe in it. I sort of forced everybody to have a Tandem account and to keep it open. But you know, there's a dynamic. You can't force that dynamic into people. It's as good as it gets. I agree. Cool. So Cedric, you know, coming to my last few questions on the list, what industries are you excited about now as an investor? Where do you see promise? Where do you see yourself investing in the next few years?
Yeah, so I'm pretty focused on fintech and DeFi, decentralized finance. I think especially in Europe, we're going to see a massive shift in how we transact with one another. There's still countries in Europe where cash is the dominant payment method, and I think that's definitely going to come to an end. I think we're going to have centralized payment methods like credit cards and PayPal and that basket. But I'm also really excited about stablecoins in general and the opportunities that decentralized finance companies bring to us right now. I'm focused on early stage pre-seed and seed, fintech, meaning anything that touches a transaction stream, or DeFi, any company, any startup that reinvents financial products or services on blockchain-based technology and decentralized infrastructure.
That's all. Cool. So last question for me actually is around this experience of you as you know, transitioning from entrepreneur to investor, or at least having been on both sides of that. What should founders look for in an investor? Obviously, this is an opportunity for you to kind of sell your own firm and kind of like your own focus as an investor. But what should founders look for in an investor? When you've seen your other founders, when you see your portfolio companies, what are the investors at last, you know, that end up helping the founders out with their endeavors?
I think investing in early stage startups is very hard because the hard factors, the things that you can rationally look at and say in a somewhat deterministic way, yes, this is going to be a good investment, they only make up maybe 10% or maybe sometimes 20%, depending on the stage of your success in investing. I think 80 to 90% of your success will come from the relationships that you build. And so it's a lot of soft factors. How well do you get along? Do you share common interests? In the end, if I had to summarize it into just one or two sentences, I would always say, I make sure you only bring someone on board as an investor that you think you're going to have lots of fun with. Fun in the board meetings, but also fun just building this company with, because it's going to be a tough journey. It's going to be a long journey. Even if things look easy or exciting right now, there's always going to be days where it's not as bright and not as easy. And I think in those days is where you definitely want to have investors on board that you feel comfortable with sharing anything that's in your mind, anything that's going on in the company, anything that concerns you, and you know they will have your back. I think in a way, taking on investors is an even more long-term commitment than sometimes a marriage, because there's literally, like, especially if your company does well, if it doesn't go bankrupt, there's no way you're going to get someone off the cap table. So I think it's a decision that shouldn't be taken lightly. And as much as investors are assessing you as a founder, I think you should have your idea of who you get along with well and what you want to ask them, what you want from them, what you think they should be contributing as they come along for the journey, as much as investors will ask you those questions. But that's something I see a little less with first-time founders, and then with founders that have done it before, it's very clear that they've learned that lesson, and they ask you a lot about how you think about certain things. What is it? How do you like to remain involved and be updated and contribute? I think that's an extremely important thing that founders shouldn't forget when they start to look for investors.
And kind of like echoing that a little bit, you know, a bad relationship with investors translates into, you know, into bad news for the company in general, right? Yeah. You know, from my side, from the entrepreneur side, you know, you can't always pick your investors hey, I want this investor because I got along with them better. But, you know, what you can do is sort of, and this echoes a little bit to one of our previous videos, a conversation with Devrim, CEO of Superpeer. You know, good practice is, you know, always play it fair. Like if you play fair by your investors, if you keep them updated, if you keep them informed, if you don't try to cheat your way in any way, you build a reputation. And in the end, in this industry, being as big but also as small as it is, you know, reputation does go a long way. So that I guess is my closing comment on that.
And one mistake that I've seen a few times with founders, inexperienced founders, is that they just optimize for the highest valuation in their early rounds. I do understand that you don't want to get too diluted early on, but I think it creates two problems. A, if you put that over your relationship, then it can hurt you down the road. And second, if you optimize just for a high valuation in your first rounds, it puts immense pressure on you to overperform so that in the next round you can still raise from tier one investors. And I've seen it kill companies, or at least split up founder teams and create a lot of drama, because they weren't able to, they've raised at a very high valuation in the first round. Then business didn't go as planned. Not everything worked out perfectly. And then they just couldn't attract tier one investors in their next round. And that kind of took the company from like a very great path that they were on to just a tier three startup. And I think that's something that founders don't think about often enough.
I agree. Cool, Cedric. I don't have any more questions. I appreciate you for joining. Anything else you want to add before we wrap it up?
No, I think it was great. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Thanks, everybody, for tuning into our podcast today. Once again, a reminder, Cedric is part of our expert network. You can go to slidememe.com/expert-network to book some office hours with him. I think he'll appreciate the, you know, coming across new companies, meeting you, giving you his advice. So check that out. He's also part of our Founders Edition plan. So if you're on Founders Edition, you'll be able to book.
Thanks so much for having me. This was fun.